someone writing from Finland was kind enough to say that my worries about talking about history were unfounded, that people really are interested in history. I'm glad to hear that, and I hope it's true, because what I'm going to talk about here is history, but all of my ideas are rooted in my study of history. I study history a great deal more than I do the latest newspapers. I spent a good part of my life putting things in the newspapers, and I know that one gets lost without historical perspective. In any case, as an old South Carolinian, I like history. So let me go straight into, since we are trying to make an American Revolution, let me talk about the American Revolution. The greatest general on the American side in the American Revolution, without question, was Benedict Arnold. Now, most of our really wise sayings down south are couched in jokes, and most people don't understand the depths of them. But there is a North Carolina expression that says, it's supposed to be the insult that one makes, "You're ugly, your feet stink, and you don't love Jesus." And that's sort of making fun of people who think in one-dimensional terms. It's say anybody who disagrees with them has nothing to learn that they can learn from. And so when I say Benedict Arnold was the greatest American general, the normal reaction is to try to prove that he was really this or really that, or he was really that somebody else was doing all the work, or this, that, and the other. No, the fact is, he was an astonishingly great general when he was on the American side. He was also the greatest, he is the name we use for treason. He switched sides, and he ended up fighting for the British. But in both cases, he was one hell of a general. When George Washington took Boston, I think that was 1776 when he took Boston, he took it by putting heavy cannon on a mountain which overlooked the city of Boston. And the British had to pull out because he could hit their ships and he could hit them from there. What is not usually discussed is how he got those cannon. At the beginning of the Revolution, we were not exactly armed to the teeth with heavy ordnance. But Benedict Arnold was a sea captain, a trader. He knew Canada. He knew America. He knew the Caribbean. And he knew that Fort Ticonderoga, a huge fort, hundreds of miles from Boston, contained a lot of heavy cannon and very little, and only a handful of British troops. So he originated the idea, and it was not the Green Mountain Boys or anybody else. He decided to go to Fort Ticonderoga, overwhelm the, I think, 86 troops there, and take those guns from that fort and a couple of others, and then transport them. He could build ships. And also used sleds, and he got those guns all the way from the other side of New York State to Massachusetts. All Washington had to do was put them on top of a hill. I'm not even sure he had to fire the things, although Arnold brought cannonballs too. because the British saw they were completely outflanked when those huge guns showed up there. So without Arnold, this first great victory of George Washington would have been impossible, and in fact, George Washington didn't think about it at all. So here's Benedict Arnold, who also, by the way, was the victory at Saratoga, the turning point of the war in 1777. He was the one who won it himself, despite the commanding General Clinton. He himself rallied the troops. It was amazing what that man did all by himself. So this was a great general and a traitor. Is that possible? Of course it's possible. In fact, every time you have a real battle on your hands, whether it's political or military, you send in spies to find out what the other side is doing right. Sitting around moaning about how bad they are won't do the job. Speaking of the Revolution, Thomas Paine, again, putting Washington down a bit, but if we talk about a person who was essential to the American Revolution, it was Thomas Paine. He wrote Common Sense, and he converted most of the people who were converted to independence with that little book. Now, if I sound like I'm putting down Washington, it's because I know how this sort of war goes. That is to say, we talk when we're reading about the American Revolution, they're always talking about how the British took this city and took that city and how hopeless things were. Well, I think we're used to people moaning about how hopeless things are. But at no point during the Revolution did Britain really control a major part of America. They had troops there. But as soon as the state, for example, they're always talking about how a third of the population was for the revolution, a third was against, and a third was neutral. That's something that I believe was Adams said later. But if that's true, one wonders why all of the governors, the British governors of all of the 13 states, without exception, were thrown out of those states. The fact is, the ground was controlled by the Americans. Interestingly enough, Britain was in exactly the same position we were in Vietnam. They had a war, it was very costly. They didn't control the countryside. They could take cities. They held New York and Charleston right through until the treaty was signed a year and a half after Cornwallis surrendered. They held cities. But the Americans could feed themselves, they could arm themselves, and the British were simply in an impossible situation because in the long run, convincing the Americans, and war is a matter of convincing, by the way, as one West Point textbook pointed out, if an army is routed and it is twice the size of the army that routs it, after it is defeated, it is still about twice the size of the army that defeated it. The difference is that they are convinced that they are defeated. They're on the run. If you've ever been in this sort of situation with very little discipline, which makes you appreciate American troops' discipline, but you're always worried about the people on your left and on your right and who's running and who's not running, because when you're really up there, you're a target. And the shoulder-to-shoulder bit works only if your troops are very disciplined. Anyway, winning a battle is a matter of convincing the other side that it's defeated. The problem with America was that the British really couldn't hold it. They couldn't convince all the Americans. They could win great victories. They could get lots of talk. but almost from the word go, they really didn't stand a chance. So if I sound like I'm putting down Washington, I think it was nice to have a Continental Army in the field. But from what I have read, which is a fair amount, the problem was that it was too much country, just like in Vietnam with us. It was very costly for Britain, and the Americans simply would not quit. So what made the difference, really, was people like Thomas Paine, who wrote Convincing Americans. And, of course, we don't like to talk about Benedict Arnold for obvious reasons. But he was a great general. I once had some interesting correspondence with a professor, military science professor at West Point. He had written a book about why the United States was able to win its independence and the Confederacy was not. And he explained this by saying that the South had slaves and therefore it couldn't just hold the territory the way that the Americans did, the way I described. That if the Yankees took the cities, the Southerners couldn't go into guerrilla warfare because they had slaves. I wrote him and pointed out that the most vicious guerrilla warfare in the Revolution, practically a state secret until Mel Gibson made a movie about it, there were more people killed and more battles fought in the state of South Carolina than in any other state. And South Carolina consisted of about 55% slave, and this was one of the most vicious, brutal civil wars that ever occurred, the one in South Carolina between the Loyalists and the Whigs. Nobody ever studies this. And I said to the military science professor, whose whole thesis was based on the idea that a state with slaves can have guerrilla warfare, that in fact, the guerrilla warfare, the biggest guerrilla warfare during the American Revolution, was in the state with the most slaves. Well, he wrote back and said he didn't know that. Now, here's a man who makes his living on this sort of thing. He just didn't know that. Which I've become used to. A lot of people just don't know. But he was honest enough to say he just flat didn't know that. The Confederacy lost the Civil War partly because we had a lot of trained generals and trained West Pointers. Our aristocracy was largely military. And so we wouldn't go into guerrilla warfare when Lee was getting ready to surrender at Appomattox. A brigadier general from where else, South Carolina, said, "What we should do, General, is drop our guns and run, and as many of us as can, we'll get together back in the mountains and fight a guerrilla war." Well, that was not the way Lee had been raised. Lee, like George Washington, believed in standing armies, discipline, the whole bit. Poor Lee. In 1870, just before he died, he told a specific quote from him that I can't quote right now, but he said, if he had known what the Yankees were going to do to the South, he would have died with his sword in his hand out in those mountains. Greatest regret of his life. But what he actually did was he trusted Grant. He trusted the honor of the North. And of course he was disastrously wrong. Now if you wonder why you can't get this quote written down, it's because another part of history you have to understand, if you're going to understand history, people are always quoting Jesus Christ as if Jesus Christ were in a free society. A lot of what Jesus said is perfectly clear to somebody who is used to an oppressive society. He had to say a lot of things in code. And so people quote him exactly as if he had sat there and written down some sort of objective ideas. Well, same thing is true of Lee. Lee had his citizenship taken away from him when he lost the Civil War. He was lucky because Jefferson Davis was chained down for 2 years, president of the Confederacy. And Lee was subject to arrest at any time, which is familiar to us today. He was free on tolerance, and he could not write down anything that might sound subversive. He certainly couldn't write down that he regretted the fact that he had surrendered and the Yankees had cheated on the whole deal. That would have put him right into prison. He wasn't an American citizen. It could have gotten him kicked out of the country. But people act as if Lee could have written down whatever he wanted to after the war. Remember, in 1870, the entire South, except Tennessee, was under military occupation still. Well, I say remember, most people don't know that. So, we didn't fight a guerrilla war. We fought a stand-up war, like Washington did, like Lee did, and that's the biggest reason we lost it. You would have had a hell of a time convincing the South that it had lost, but what Lee did, he had just been made commander-in-chief of all the Confederate armed forces, and he surrendered them all. At Appomattox, not just the army he was commanding, but the entire Confederate army. He wanted the bloodshed to end. Well, it didn't end. It continued right into Reconstruction. So, I hope this isn't confusing people. This is the usual problem with talking about history, is you have to jump from one era to another. I'm jumping between two eras, and trying, actually three, because I'm talking about the American Revolution versus the Civil War and trying to apply or to give you some material to apply this to today. One thing we might, the reason I mentioned Thomas Paine is because this will sound familiar, especially to Irving, who is sitting there facing 20 years in prison and Austria, David Irving, because of what he wrote. He disagrees about the number of Jews killed in the Holocaust. Thomas Paine was born in England, but during the entire rest of his life, he would have been under a death sentence if he had returned to England. This was long after the American Revolution was over, but what he said was, had said in some pamphlets, was considered to be subversive by the British government, and he would have been hanged. He went to France. He was arrested in France by the one phase of the French Revolution. Had quite a life. But all that time, he would have been executed had he shown up in his native Britain, because Britain, then as now, had subversion laws that someone could be punished for saying things, for writing things, just as they can today. And as the court said in the Crown versus Pierce, 1987, the truth is no excuse. And so Paine was under a death sentence. So one of the greatest patriots America ever had, certainly one of the most important, was under the same kind of sentence our people are under in Europe. So there's nothing new about David Irving being imprisoned and facing 20 years in Austria for disagreeing about the number of Jews killed in the Holocaust. After all, I'd like to remind you that all those European countries with those hate laws condemn capital punishment in the United States. In fact, in order to get a sadistic child killer out of Europe, the United States has to promise that they're not going to execute him. They're going to treat him nice. And in Austria, you don't face 20 years in prison for murder. But they're very self-righteous about us, about our laws. So Thomas Paine was under the same situation. In fact, if they had managed to find a way with David Irving, he went to visit in Austria, and they used wiretaps and all these other things that you can't use against communists. I remember people raising hell when that kind of thing was used against communists. But they managed to grab him, and the British could have done something similar. And according to the present rules, certainly, there'd be nothing wrong with that. He had written things that the British government didn't like. And if they could grab him and get him there, they would hang him, which was a sentence that they gave to murderers. Actually, of course, Irving is facing a sentence a good deal heavier than a murderer would face in Austria. But the rule holds. They would have hung him. And so there's nothing particularly new about the situation that we're facing today. Patriots, idealists, who brave the authorities, are faced with draconian punishments. And this is nothing that was invented in this century. It is just applied to us now. But if I've got to pick sides, I think I would rather be with Thomas Paine than with all the people who actively or passively, and let me remind you of this, a lot of people will talk about world opinion. World opinion is important. If it happened in South Africa, it was terrible. There's no excuse for the Netherlands, for example, not allowing immigration. You can hear, if they didn't allow immigration, the liberals here would be raising bloody hell. But then, the Europeans have these laws against free speech. And oddly enough, all these liberals become complete American provincials. They say, well, they have that in Europe. I don't have any obligation to object to that or talk about that. So, passively supporting tyranny is still supporting tyranny. So, my meandering discussion of history gets us around to a point which I hadn't actually thought about in those terms much before, and that is, liberals are always talking about world opinion. Liberals are always raising hell about mistreatment of immigrants in other countries. And if some European country decides not to admit immigrants from the third world, I will bet you that those liberals will say that's their business, that all white countries and only white countries must admit third worlders in huge numbers to solve the, quote, race problem, unquote, by which anybody with logic would know they're talking about the white problem, because they're only talking about white countries. All white countries must bring in third worlders and integrate with them. And only white countries do. Nobody's protesting about Japanese attitudes or Taiwanese attitudes or African attitudes. No. But while liberals, and especially, and respectable conservatives even more so, they try desperately to be more liberal than the liberals on immigration. While they are very much interested in world opinion on anything that agrees with them, when it comes to free speech, they suddenly say, well, that's none of our business. We shouldn't be criticizing the Austrians for throwing a scholar into prison. We shouldn't demand free speech in other places. And in fact, if somebody here puts something on the internet that liberals don't approve of, quote, hate, unquote, which covers pretty well everything they don't approve of, they don't say this person is exercising his First Amendment rights, which is what they always said about communists, you'll remember. No, they say this person is hiding behind the American Constitution in his own country. If I write what I think and put it on the internet, I'm not exercising an American's right to free speech. Listen to what they say. They say this person is hiding behind the First Amendment. If they could get their hands on him, then he would get the punishment he, this is implied, deserves. So, very two-sided. It's a good argument to use. Why is it that you're so worried about making sure that the Third World pours into every European country, but you're not concerned about freedom of speech in those countries? Well, nobody ever says that, so they get away with it. And that's really the way that we tend to fight. Hope I'm not stretching the analogy too much, but we fight too much like Washington and Lee did. We always want to get out there and be respectable and worry about the rules that they set down. And I think we have to be a good deal more ruthless in condemning their side, looking into what they say, guerrilla warfare, if you will. Let me just throw in a last point that occurs to me in this same dual liberal thinking that we never call them on. And that's in the area of minimum sentencing. Now, you know that a lot of states impose minimum sentencing, and liberals have raised hell about the very idea of not letting a liberal judge decide to let somebody off for the 14th time. 14th, by the way, is not an overstatement. Here in South Carolina, a kid, 19 years old, he had been dragged in front of the court 18 times on reckless driving. He finally killed himself and two other kids in a car and running away from the police. Nobody's got to ask all of those judges and all of those lawyers to take any moral responsibility for killing these people. Whereas if I'm a segregationist, then I am responsible for church bombings back in the 1950s. But minimum sentences, to get back to that point, in New York City, Washington, D.C., Hawaii, and a bunch of other places, they have a minimum sentence if any person is caught with a gun on him who has no criminal record whatever. They have a minimum, no choice, sentence of 1 year in prison. In Britain, or rather in Europe, I can't quite keep them straight which law is which, but if you disagree with the official numbers in the Holocaust, there is a minimum sentence. It used to be 1 year, I think it's 2 years. Now remember, liberals are against, all these same people are fanatically against minimum sentencing on child molesters, rapists, repeat armed robbers. These people, they are wildly against this minimum sentencing. But when it comes to violating their rules, carrying a gun or saying the wrong thing about the Holocaust, there's never any question that there should be a minimum required sentence. I think it might be time we did a little guerrilla warfare and started facing with, instead of sitting back and like Lee or Washington, though I don't want to be too critical of them, but instead of drawing up our line and fighting on whatever ground the other side formally chooses to fight on, I think we need a little guerrilla warfare. I think we need to get in there and say that this person is supporting the suppression of freedom of speech, instead of backing up and saying, well, capital punishment is all right, or this, that, and the other. Maybe a little more offensive tactics, maybe a little more guerrilla tactics is the lesson of this rather wandering discussion. I'd like to know if you like this. I never get any comments, so if you could put something on Stormfront or on Bob's blog, WhitakerOnline.org/blog, I would appreciate it. This is Bob Whitaker, the Untrained Eye. Hope to talk to you again.